just carry on at my own level because we don't have quite amplification. I was actually at the Royal Society of Arts when Susan Greenfield made her speech, and I felt actually the same as you did, I have to say.
Clearly, just not
I think
played
she's a great speaker, and she carries everybody with her, and I actually did have this terrible moment where I had this sort of, you know, there's Professor Susan Greenfield, very admired person, and she's talking away and she's carrying me along with her just as one would in a story, and then I had this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach that I don't actually agree with what you're saying, Susan. And it was a very, very difficult moment, I think, because essentially, yes, I agree with you. She's a top neuroscientist and she's getting it wrong on that one.
It was really painful. I was very sad and very sorry, because a lot of people would believe what she says without question or comment, when in fact military research into computer game playing proves the opposite of what she's saying in some respects. But also, she has no experience of what she's talking about at all. It's just outrageous.
Anyone else feel that they want to shoot the messenger when it comes to computer games?
I joined that bandwagon, no problem. I first heard Susan give that sort of speech in 2006 at the James Martin Institute launch in Oxford. And what I find most surprising about it is that for someone working in neuroscience knows exactly the role that the computer games industry is making to visualizing technologies in that area. So it's completely unbelievable, but nevertheless, you know, completely misguided, I think, that those, as you say, that's such a central way in which a number of scientists are developing. I mean, this link between computer games and surgery is one instance of that collaboration. And it does seem to me that she's well off on that, but maybe that's enough.
Anyway, just to take it away from that. And I do think the essential message is the issue of do we shoot the messenger? And I think all of you have had a look at animal assistants over there. And I'm interested in those images because, of course, they do something to you. And that is an artist. She was at the Royal College of Art. And I think it's an interesting one. You see images that unsettle you. What does that do? How does that affect the debate? Does anyone I'd like actually everyone to comment a bit on the way artists use images and the way the artist uses the power of art. And it's not always in the service of the message that perhaps people want to hear.
Where is the lady whose art it is? She was just there. Why don't you come and say that? Because you should know better than us. But all I will say in introduction is when I look at your images, one thing that really strikes me as different from having a debate is there's an enormous physical, powerful reaction in me that I don't get hardly ever often, either in reading a story or in listening to people talk about things, because it's so immediate, and because we deal in symbols so much, they're so rich, it's so massive, even if it's one picture, but in your mind.
Would you like to comment on animal assistance?
First of all, I would like to say that I see this as design and not art, and the thing that's important for me and the reason why I choose to refer myself still as a designer is when I try to put these scenarios into reality, I try and make them as realistic as possible, as normal as possible. When you look at this image, you see that this is abnormal, but it should relate to life and look feasible and look real. And that to me is the point of tension where things become interesting, where things become questionable, debatable, real, unreal.
Okay, and I'm also was interested, I think, in the break in discussing a little bit the issues raised by the extract that Andy showed by Endemol of the Dutch game show, which basically sort of manipulated the audience's emotions in terms of this kidney donor game. Does anybody have any comments about this, I suppose, this issue of entertainment as art and its position in the world of ethics?
Yeah, several people. Okay.
Well, I dispute the fact that that actually constitutes art. It is a media product, and it's a very clever one. But I think the debate that's been going on here is much more about really quite an ancient tension, if you like, between science as utopian in its intentions and art as the very frequently dystopian reflection of the fear that the changes that science can bring inspire in all sorts of people. That's probably more so in some literary in some sort of literary products. But, you know, people love dystopias. Why is it that medieval artists, when they painted heaven, it was never as interesting as hell?
I think one of the things that is different about art and science is that art can measure and examine the emotion that it produces, and certainly it was fascinating seeing that program after having read about it in the papers. Good science always tries to at least measure as far as it can what the result is in terms of outcome. And I was just interested to know whether organ donations had increased in Holland as a result of what was done there or not.
I can't actually honestly answer that. What I can tell you, though, is that the Netherlands is a particularly interesting case through which to look at a number of bioethical issues. Their attitude to, you know, we've heard of health tourism over the last few years. The Netherlands is one of those places where certain views on these issues is, I think, much more engaging than perhaps certainly in the UK. I think there is an interest to undertake provocations like that in a much more willing form. And certainly if you look at the state of the healthcare system, you know, there seems to be a greater willingness to embrace aesthetic modifications on a state-funded system. So, you know, dental surgery is the case that people talk about, where one has the capacity to utilize the healthcare system for cosmetic dental interventions. And I think those sorts of issues do engage everyone on a very visceral level. I remember a slightly different example. A couple of years ago, I walked into a Borders Books, and in the magazine rack, I saw one magazine that had on the front cover a story about saving the stem cells of your child. And you'll be aware of this, that if you can save the stem cells from the umbilical cord of your child, you can protect it against a number of blood-related disorders. And seeing that front cover story in this magazine confirms the way in which the science becomes meaningful for people. And I think it is through television, through popular science, through magazines, in which we are confronted with those choices. And that's where I feel there is art in this programming, despite it being, you know, endemol and most likely to get a lot of publicity, which it did. There are a number of techniques we employ in a creative way to engage people morally on those issues.
Paul, do you think your play is going to be controversial when it comes out?
I'm not sure. It could be. It depends on the point of view of the person that comes to see it. I would hope that there are enough points of view represented in the play that, you know, anyone who comes to see it would feel that it's not polemical, so therefore that it shouldn't be controversial. It should be just, you know, the beginning of a debate or a discussion.
Is it likely to be welcomed by the Catholic Church, for example?
No, I don't think so. No. There is a couple who do travel to, and they are a Catholic, they're a very religious couple who travel to Switzerland for an assisted suicide, so I think that probably would be, you know, that wouldn't be welcomed by the Catholic Church, but
I mean, if I could chip in here and be more provocative in responding to that, because I think that, you know, without a decent publicist, you could be in trouble. I mean, I say that maybe not because of the content of what you're presenting through the play, but actually the issues themselves can become subject to a range of agendas of different organizations that might operate around your play. The play itself could be completely innocuous in terms of its content, but if someone wishes to make it the subject of concern about their issue, then you could face that kind of controversy in the paper, in the press. And so, yeah. I mean, I remember it's only recently that Edinburgh University, a very prolific science institution, has only recently, I think it was 2005 or 6, appointed a science press officer. You know, generally universities have generic press officers that, quite frankly, are rubbish. But, you know, now they've got a science-specific press officer, and that's where we are, actually. The expertise in this area is really limited to deal with handling controversies surrounding science.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring Chamu in, actually, as we were talking about assisted suicide, and you raised this issue of inconsistencies in international law, and you brought in assisted suicide as one of those examples of this inconsistency. Am I right in thinking, or are you saying there should that the current diversity in different legal frameworks is more appropriate?
Just to clarify, what I was talking about is if we have a certain ethical position that we espouse, and you know, within this particular jurisdiction, it is not allowed. So, you know, policy is supposed to serve people within that particular jurisdiction. And if it's a private decision that they make to actually get out of that jurisdiction, go out of the remit or range of that policy and go to another country, that's a different position that's espoused. So we try to look at, well, how do you make policy that will be effective for everybody that it actually serves and it's supposed to be serving? And if you find that one particular position is an ethically coherent, good position to hold, then how does that actually get translated into policy? And, of course, different countries within Europe have different positions. I took that example because it was already cited to say, well, but then if you take, for example, research could have been conducted in one particular jurisdiction, stem cell research, but then the application of that could be in different jurisdictions. And, for example, do you actually allow that? Or, for example, in Germany, you know, embryo research can actually be conducted with embryos that have been produced before a certain cutoff point, but in another country, that can be imported. But you can't really create your own embryos within Germany, so that's an ethically, you know, incoherent position to take, because you want to take advantage of any research that you can do, but what is the point of that, you know, cutoff date? And say, well, you can actually import embryos from somewhere. You know, what difference does it make if it's a, you know, embryo that is being created in Germany or from somewhere else in the world? I mean, it is incoherent.
These areas that are impossible to have consensus about internationally.
Well, it's not the point about what kind of course you have disagreements and all that can be embedded in, you know, within policy in different ways. But it is about it is reflected in the, you know, voting patterns that you can actually see. To what extent are we taking all of these different, do we understand all of that? Is it embedded clearly? Or do we actually need a much more flexible, you know, governance mechanism? Because one of the main questions about, you know, law and regulation is, when is something a private issue? When is something, you know, within the purview of public morality? And some of these issues people would say are very, very private issues, but if you want to bring it within the sort of public sphere of policy making, then what exactly should be included there and what should be excluded there? I think there has to be much more debate about that in a continuing basis. Yeah. And the point is, do we have the parliament legislation about that particular area, or do we have, for example, a regulatory authority like the, you know, human HFEA, which basically takes a case-by-case look at that? And how else could we include flexibility and, you know, reflect much more of what society might expect or different points of view might, you know, sort of be represented better in policy making?
Yeah, I mean, public and private, I think that's a very interesting concept to bring. But I want to sort of, we're running out of time, and I'm aware there may be some people now in our audience that would like to add some points. They're getting one right over, right in the back there, and then after that, the lady in front of her.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, there's an idea that
can
science...
Can you point towards the...
There's an idea that science is quite an elitist tradition, and there's an idea that art is also quite an elitist tradition. So just coming back to the sort of the overarching question on screens, If policymaking can also be seen as elitist, how do you see these three things coming together to make democratic policymaking?
Who would like to take that? I think we have a chance for only one response. Andy, go on then.
All right, I mean, it's a great question, and I think that there are different elites working often in isolation of each other. And I think one of my concerns, it's quite interesting the interactions you have between them, though. You know, I know people who would regard themselves as bio-artists that have got nice, fat Wellcome Trust grants to do their work and come out at the other end completely disenchanted with that sort of collaboration, and as if it's somehow, on the one hand, they're having to conform to certain agendas that the funding body is trying to set, and that compromises their own integrity creatively. I think that's probably one serious way in which we can do it. And I think if you look at the composition of even things like Nuffield, you know, Nuffield Council on Bioethics, those three elites are not clearly represented. And I think that's certainly one way in which it's a quite bland, dull way in which we can work towards even those elites collaborating. But you know, we are still at that point before the elites even talking to each other. So if one looks at even the HFEA, HGC, these are all elitist organizations, but still incredibly narrow in their composition. So there's still work to be done. Just very briefly, at this launch in Oxford in 2006, there was one artist session. A couple of you might have been there. And for me, it was somewhat of a turning point. This conference where Susan had a keynote and all the rest of the people giving their philosophical take on the future of humanity. But within this very lovely artistic session were Dame Susie Leather, who was listening and watching and seeing the interpretations of artists on her subject matter. I think it is for me, and it remains a template of how we should go forward.
And
hi, yeah, sorry to over-exercise you, Andy, Mia. This is a question for you, or maybe more of a comment. I'm not familiar with the Kurtz artist that you were discussing.
Steve Kurtz.
But it did strike me that you were a bit mocking of the idea that he could be perceived as a bioterrorist. But it strikes me that you can't have your cake and eat it. If artists are going to be engaged in policy, they may become political enemies of people. They may become enemies of the state. I mean, that's what engagement entails, and I don't think you can have it so that you're allowed to engage in one sense, but you're not allowed to be regarded as an enemy. Just to sort of clarify that, an artist may be an enemy in the sense that they may attack a particular policy, and their weapon may be biological if they're, as many artists are starting to do, sort of use biology as a means of expression. And I'm thinking of the luminous rabbit, and I think I heard of someone wearing embryos as earrings. That may not be the kind of bioweapons you have in mind, but they are, in a sense, bioweapons.
Yeah, I just want to take that, actually, to start off with, because Steve Kurtz is, I'm sure, would count himself as a dissident. And he's published things that he would call dissident. He most certainly is not and has never intended to be a bioterrorist. He was using amateur science to demonstrate a point artistically when, by accident, unfortunately his wife died, and they called the ambulance. And then there was a widespread panic because he had a lab in his apartment. The whole mechanism of the Patriot Act, post 9/11, was brought in. And the problem was the authorities didn't realize they'd made a mistake to start off with. And then when they did realize they'd made a mistake, they decided, rather than lose face, they persecuted him. So I don't think it's fair to say that he was even toying with the idea of being a bioterrorist. He for sure was not a bioterrorist. But he did stand up for the right for the everybody, artists, general public, to investigate areas of science. And that's not quite the same thing as having your cake and eating it.
If I give a brief comment to elaborate on that, I think the question, what is my cake, occurs. And I think that in Steve's case, I think broadly in the case of bioartists, one of the questions that, as Rob alluded to at the start with thinking about ethics, is should artists, or what should be the ethical standards by which artists working in this area should be governed? And is it something similar to the standards that scientists should be governed, or is it something different? And I think that problem has yet to be resolved, and that prohibits us from answering what is our cake, because I think artists are still not quite sure what is the realm of ethical constraints in which they should work. And I think that it's difficult to be too optimistic about it, but I think that some artists are working closer with laboratories to go through some of those issues and try to understand what's at stake, because it's not just the artists who have to face those questions. Scientists themselves working in certain areas are confronted with that very same issue of being perceived as a bioterrorist. Thomas Butler, a US scientist, is one of those people. And I think that, again, the role of collaborative ethical development is central.
Can I just ask how long we've got? That's it. Okay, just very, very quickly. Can I just ask the panel to comment on whether artists who make work about ethics need to be ethical in themselves? In other words, do you have to consider your ethics in what you write and how you write about ethics? For example, Justina? Mm-hmm.
That's a very good question. Do they have to be? No, they don't have to be. Should they be? I don't know. I hate to make these prescriptive comments, because this is where all this control freakery starts. For your own personal safety, you should be very aware of what you're saying to whom and why and in what context, and that's all I would say. But as for your imagination within the limits of your own mind and what you choose to write, I should say certainly not. But if you think that, I mean, but then there's the ethics of thinking. Is it bad to think things? Or good? Or, you have to make your own mind up about that. Yes.
I don't think they would necessarily have to start with your own ethics, because I think the imagination should take you wherever it wants. And I think it was interesting, just very quickly, about what Chamu was saying about that, you know, a dance, for instance, could contain more possibilities and more eloquence than a piece of legislation. That's just, you know, maybe a utopian ideal, but so that if you allow the art to take you there, you know, if you start with the ethics, then it might never bring you there.
What am I?
Well, as far as I see it, I think the whole concept of ethics and the whole concept of right and wrong itself has to be questioned. Whether, you know, what utility does it actually serve, rather than is that the starting point?
Okay, I'm going to go for being morally engaged is valuable, but ethically constrained, less so.
Okay, thank you very much. And let me hand over to Professor Nigel.
Thank you. Well, this has been a delightful afternoon. Let me, first of all, invite you to thank our panelists for a terrific time. I think everyone has been quite fascinated by this conversation, which is part of a very broad conversation many of us are involved with, and it will continue, and we'll be in touch with you about it. Now, I understand this building is also used as a theater. at least so rumor has it. We have to be out of this space very, very smartly. But Matt, who is over here, wave your hand, Matt, will lead you down to where we have alcoholic refreshment, which is the reason we really all came. We look forward to seeing you all down there in about 2 or 3 minutes' time. Follow Matt down the stairs. And he's going to give you instructions as well. Thank you all very much.